For a blind and print-impaired audience, the North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week, and this week's issue is dated October the 7th of 2020. And thanks for joining us today. I am John Federson, your reader, and I only have this brief announcement from our legal department. No, Loggerhead Turtles were harmed in the performance of our theme music. And with that boilerplate out of the way, we can get going with today's issue. And we will move back to the op-ed page after we get through some of our other articles, the news articles, and this one by Jeremy Borden from Durham, Power Pack. The votes had been counted, and the surprising result was in. Alexandra Valladares had won the coveted People's Alliance PAC endorsement for Durham School Board over an established, beloved incumbent and longtime People's Alliance member. It was a big moment for Valladares and her supporters. She was poised to become the first Latinx person on the school board, but the endorsement, it soon turned out, wasn't quite what it seemed. In many ways, the People's Alliance PAC endorsement is vital in Durham politics. It comes with an army of volunteer campaigners and carries the prestige of the area's most powerful and prominent progressive organization in this Democratic stronghold. The organizations are split by the PAC's electioneering and the People's Alliance issues-based grassroots work. All members of the People's Alliance are members of the PAC and can vote on endorsements. And these PAC endorsements tend to have a ripple effect, looked to by other organizations, including media like the Indy, for a sense of who possesses progressive bona fides. It's roughly 1,200-strong membership, many whom are active citizens, is a powerful force in down-ballot state and local elections, where endorsements carry particular sway. The Alliance has accrued unmatched local power since its founding in 1976. It has fought for both candidates and causes, including the successful push for a $15 minimum wage for city employees. But in some ways, the Alliance is a victim of its own success, reckoning with an increasingly prosperous city that's still plagued by racial inequity, creating a divide in the organization and the area as a whole. With her endorsement sealed, Valladares thought her long night was over. But she learned there was some kind of hiccup at the PAC's January endorsement meeting. The vote apparently wasn't finalized after all, she tells the Indy. Someone had decided there needed to be a recount, and Valladares was asked to wait, and so she did, humiliated, agonizing over what was happening in a room that had gotten tense and cold toward her. She looked at the mothers with children in tow who had come to support her, now forced to wait even longer before they could go home after the grueling, hours-long endorsement process at a meeting of more than 600 people, the largest PAC meeting in the group's history. Valladares didn't want to wait for a recount of an endorsement in her bid against a white incumbent, Steve Unruh, with close ties to the organization's mostly white and longest-tenured members. At 38, she thought Durham Schools needed its first Latinx member, a representative who could speak for a school community that's 33% Latinx. For her, they couldn't wait either. Valladares also believed she had built up goodwill within the powerful local PAC in her time volunteering and organizing with them since 2015. She wanted to take a shot, working hard to develop relationships with the other grassroots volunteers, collaborating closely with them to earn the endorsement. Ostensibly, that's something the group could have celebrated too, especially once she won the hard-fought endorsement. She is a woman of color from the working class and a Durham Public School graduate. She was looking to organize and shake up the status quo on behalf of black and brown people in a Durham school district that has struggled with the gaps between students of color and their white peers. What could be more progressive than that? In what should have been one of Valladares' proudest moments, the sullen look on the faces of the leaders who had told her after the wait that she had, in fact, won the endorsement, tarnished her victory. the nasty comments and sideways glances that came afterward toward her and her mother, she says, created a tense dynamic. Then several prominent members of the allegedly progressive PAC organized a campaign for the incumbent, endorsement be damned, and sent around a widely circulated letter touting him. Despite their best efforts, Valladares still easily won the election in March and now serves on the school board. She says her candidacy was a threat to what some white liberals think the proper role is for a person of color. She says she began to feel othered in People's Alliance meetings, even by other people of color. She says, somehow, I think being able to have a seat at the table and become electable has threatened a lot of notions. I think there is something to be said about the kind of help that is people staying in their place and helping them versus people of color taking on a leadership role. An old guard versus new guard dynamic, one that also reflects power dynamics and, for some, implicit racism in the historically white group, has developed within the People's Alliance, something that leaders acknowledge in interviews. It is also reflected more broadly in the Bull City as racial tension mounts. Durham City and County are seen as increasingly unequal for people of color, critics within Durham's progressive political circles say, as the city's upscale development becomes a hotspot for home buyers, new jobs, and trendy restaurants catering primarily to white people. The question of who benefits and who is in power also emerges with the PAC's bank account. Every candidate that has received the PAC's endorsement since 2017 has contributed substantial sums, according to analysis of campaign finance filings from the State Board of Elections. So far, this year, contributions from People's Alliance PAC endorsees represent about 75% of its total $47,000 budget. All of the candidates, 100%, who contributed since 2017 are also PAC endorsers. The campaign money, which is not an explicit requirement for People's Alliance or Durham politics, is just one form of how wealth and privilege manifests. Critics say Durham's power brokers are using the language of liberal values without giving people of color the one thing that would truly foster change, access to power and wealth. Omar Beasley, the chairman of a different local PAC, the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, says that Durham's version of liberal values hasn't done enough for black residents. He says, it's difficult for me to say Durham is progressive. Specifically, he says that as Durham prospers, too few city and county contracts go to black-owned firms, and leaders fail to appoint enough members of the black community to coveted roles on boards and commissions. Sometimes those divisions are along racial lines, but that can often be complicated by leaders of color who aren't seen as doing enough for the communities they should represent, Beasley says. He asks, white Durham is telling black Durham what to say about black Durham? Referring to the People's Alliance, we don't need no white saviors. Give us an opportunity and give us a seat at the table. Katie Todd, president of the People's Alliance, as of this year, acknowledges the tension that has developed within the alliance and the city. She says that while the longest-serving members are mostly white, the group aims to grapple with those power dynamics coming to the forefront. While these things are true, she says, they're not necessarily permanent. We have been no stranger to the concerns and criticisms levied around the People's Alliance. She also says that other PACs and groups will be welcome at the table to help with reforms. The door has to be open, and the room has to be inviting, she says. Carl Kinney, a pastor and longtime journalist who is also a member of the Durham Committee, says the ongoing racial controversy around Durham County's black manager points to an incredibly fractious environment. He says, right now we're seeing the peak of racial tension in Durham. There's a sense that the white liberals in Durham are clouded by their white supremacy. At least among the area's power brokers, it wasn't always this way. Leaders of the People's Alliance and the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People would meet and hash out shared candidate endorsements at the Chicken Hut on Fayetteville Street in the early 90s, Kenny says. That changed when the development of NC 751 and South Point Mall negotiations were underway. that mostly white people's lands had environmental concerns, while the Durham Committee saw an opportunity to create jobs. Kenny says, this massive political divide developed that is incredibly contentious, and in some ways the black community sees it rooted in race, white privilege, white supremacy, and power. Beasley says the struggle within Durham's various groups, all ostensibly fighting for a more progressive future, will have their own version of what victory looks like. He says power has to be taken away, and when it's taken away, it has to be taken away in a fight. Right now, we're fighting for a piece of power, and I don't see anybody giving that away. Nana Asante-Smith, a PAPAC leader and coordinator, says the organization's first step in addressing issues of inequity and white privilege starts with acknowledging them. She says there has to be an acknowledgement of these issues through a racial equity lens. It requires an organization largely founded as a white organization that needs to be able to relinquish some sort of power. Asante Smith admits that asking anyone to give up control will be a difficult road. She says the reality of the situation that exists is that we're still working within politics. There's a commitment by individuals to furthering those political agendas. One way the power dynamic within the People's Alliance has manifested itself is that candidates, many of whom are incumbents, give large sums of money to the organization. Of the $176,500 the PAC has raised since 2017, more than $85,000, nearly half the total budget, has come from candidates it has endorsed, according to campaign finance filings. The dollars raised from candidates versus overall donors has gone from 28% in 2017 to around 44% the next 2 years. So far in 2020, it's jumped to 75%. Candidates give anywhere from $350 to $3,000 per election cycle from their campaign accounts. There are some exceptions. In a two-month span in 2017, Mayor Steve Shule contributed a total of $5,000. For Valladares, when a PAC coordinator asked for $2,500 following her endorsement, she was shocked. I was put under a lot of pressure to give money that week, she says. I was crushed. I was like, oh my God, I don't have this money. Valladares and Asante Smith later agreed on $1,000 whenever Valladares could give it. She made the contribution in February, her filings show. Ultimately, Valladares gave the contribution but believes the PAC should develop a process that respects candidates regardless of what they can contribute for the next underdog, as she puts it. I'm glad there are leaders that have a way to communicate and value the person more than the money, she says of Asante Smith. Asante Smith, one of five People's Alliance PAC coordinators, says the PAC asks for contribution from endorsed candidates in order to fund its operation. That has been a big part of why the group is successful at the ballot box, providing funding for poll workers and messaging for candidates that it believes will advance a progressive agenda, she says. We raise money well, and we raise money effectively. Asante Smith says the amount of money the PAC asks for candidates varies depending on timing, strategy, the election cycle, and other factors. There's no uniform, concrete formula, she says. That said, she says the group knows its history and image as a historically white organization, unwilling to share the spoils of its efforts or acknowledge the barriers to entry for those with fewer funds. She doesn't believe the candidates' finances play a role in endorsement. The broader membership, which votes on endorsement, wouldn't be aware of those details when casting votes, she points out. But she says that they should still make changes to become more inclusive. It's something I wrestle with as a black woman, she says. I really believe that we as black people have to be present in the spaces where we want to see change and take ownership. I don't think that absolves the PA of doing what it must do to address these issues. I believe we are aware of it. The real question is, what are we willing to do about what we know? When Valladares began to attend Alliance events, starting in early 2015, she felt inspired. She soon took leadership roles and helped found the group's Latinx caucus, Nuestra Gente, with Ivan Almonte in early 2018. She felt good. I was like, this could become a political home, she says. Once Valladares campaigned against UNRUH, the tenor changed. Members accused her of scheming to get the endorsement, she says. The pro-UNRUH letter circulated by some PAC members was a tough blow. Valladares felt she had to fight the same organization she had already supposedly won over. She says, because this is about the power, then you do see progressive people fighting each other and trying to discredit each other's work. The letter touted UNRUH's credentials without making mention of Valladares directly. However, it also said, while it is rare for many of us to support a candidate outside of the PA endorsements, we feel in this case that Steve is the much stronger candidate. The letter may have backfired. In response, critical race scholar Rhonda Taylor Bullock circulated another letter on behalf of Valladares. She said that even though UNRUH was well qualified, opposing an opportunity for a qualified Latina to sit on the Durham School Board in a majority black and brown district would be wrong. She wrote, in the historical context described above, signing on to support a white male over a highly qualified Latina woman is an act of white supremacy. More than 150 others co-signed the letter. The original letter didn't explicitly break the alliance's bylaws, but generally, leadership hopes members don't collectively organize against endorsees. Asante Smith said, I thought it was very insulting that took place. The message they sent on that occasion was very clear. It was that we are willing to defy our own norms, benefits, and structures for a white man. Since then, things have been fraught between Valladares and the group. New rules have been proposed against elected officials taking on leadership roles within the alliance, which Valladares believes target her. She has stepped down from her leadership roles and volunteer work within the group, but hasn't made a decision yet on whether to resign as a member. Mayor Shul signed the letter supporting UNRUH. If he found himself in a situation similar to Valladares, he said, I would just think it was politics. Shul has been a member of the People's Alliance since its inception. He says the group used to be about 90% white, which has changed markedly in recent years, and its longevity is a testament to the organization's strength. Shul, who is white, says he views his work to push for a more affordable housing and a better bus system, among other issues, through a racial equity lens. He says the fight for racial justice is still the most important work that any of us can do. It's been that way for my whole life. It's the most important work that I do. Katie Todd, the People's Alliance president, says the group is focused on racial equity and has begun a strategic planning process that will find more strategies to ensure it's a more inclusive organization, including racial equity training for its members. And she says, as people continue to move to Durham, we must educate our transplants on the history of what has happened and how they can be a part of eradicating systemic racism and creating a truly affordable Durham, and that all folks have access to the economic opportunities many of us take for granted. We have no illusions that we're not going to make more mistakes. It's unclear exactly how these tensions within the People's Alliance or the city at large will be resolved, if at all. But given the power the group wields, the answer has dramatic consequences for Durham's progressive image and the future of the left in this blue bastion. For Valladares, it's hard to tell whether the Alliance's traditional power brokers are thinking of the group's well-being and future, or just their own. She says, I think Durham, being the progressive beacon of the South, we can do better. Also from Durham, Blast Radius by Charlie Zong. When Chris Keenan pulled up to his childhood home in East Durham last month, he saw seven mothers standing resolutely with a crowd of children. He quickly realized that something was very wrong. While searching for an armed suspect, police had drawn their guns on three kids playing tag earlier that afternoon. The oldest, age 15, was handcuffed. The mothers were furious at what they saw as the latest example of unjustified harsh treatment by police. The mom said, says Chris Keenan, "The police just came over here and threw my child on the ground and pointed guns at the kids. I was blown away by what had just taken place." Incidentally, Keenan had come to Rochelle Manor Apartments to help run an event designed to bridge the police-community divide. Mayor Steve Shule, who arrived on the scene to attend Keenan's event, quickly arranged a meeting between the families and Police Chief Sarah Lynn Davis. "I thank God we came right after it happened because we had the mayor there," Keenan said. "It was about to escalate pretty fast without a lot of blowing up." Helping families in communities like Rochelle Manor feel heard and supported by police and city leaders is why Keenan helped create BLAST, or Building Leaders for a Solid Tomorrow. 5 years ago, the 32-year-old father of three, a physical education teacher and football coach at Neil Magnet Middle School, began giving away toys and bikes at Christmas to kids at Rochelle, where he lived as a kid. After George Floyd's death in May, Keenan organized a rally for athletes to protest racial injustice outside the Durham County Courthouse. Some of Keenan's former students, Duke University football coach David Cutcliffe, and members of the Duke football and men's basketball teams attended. After that, Keenan and three friends decided to put a name to their efforts and launched BLAST, which now includes a team of around 30 volunteers, made up of students, lawyers, doctors, athletes, and other professionals. In an era marked by fraught and sometimes volatile relationships between police and the communities they serve, BLAST is working to strengthen relationships between residents and the police working in their neighborhoods. Chief Davis praised Keenan for creating an avenue for positive community engagement between the police and the community in a statement emailed to the 9th Street Journal. The chief was intrigued by Keenan's passion, police spokesman Jacqueline Werner said. She said, "Using the trust they built and trusting us, we've been able to allow our officers to go to the events and start new dialogue, as well as continue some existing conversations." Persistent lobbying helped grow BLAST from a project by four friends into a group with significant buy-in from decision makers. Keenan said, "We send texts out to every judge, every lawyer, every city council member, the chief, sheriff, the mayor, inviting them to events." Some locals see efforts to better unite residents and police as urgent. Gun violence is on the rise. As of September 19th, there were 689 shootings in the city this year. That's up from a total of 495 to that date last year. And after high-profile police shootings like Jacob Blake and Breonna Taylor, relationships are frayed between officers and Durham's black residents in particular. Since July, BLAST has put on 9 Safe Zone Friday events at Rochelle Manor and at 4 Durham Housing Authority complexes. Keenan and his co-founders hand out groceries and school supplies and go door-to-door to sign students up for free tutoring. Over a dozen police officers typically attend, allowing kids to enjoy a few hours outdoors without the risk of hearing gunfire, Keenan said. He said, "My biggest concern is simple. Can the kids come outside and play?" After police body camera footage emerged in July of an incident in 2019 where a Durham police officer was accused of assaulting a high school student, and recent protests over the police treatment of the Rochelle Manor youngsters, BLAST's mission has deepened. Now improving relationships between police and residents, especially youth, has become more urgent for Keenan. He said, "People think that these matters are just national matters. I'm glad we were able to have a real incident in this city that we can shine a light on, but that nobody was hurt from physically. But we still have some healing to do." Keenan's personal history motivates him to help the community heal. Like Zachariah Cornelius and Jalen Harris, two of the three kids at the center of that drawn-gun incident, Keenan grew up at Rochelle Manor, experiencing the social and financial challenges that many children living in subsidized housing still face. Keenan said, "My mom raised us in a tough environment, and she did a great job. I could never thank her enough." Out of 10 childhood friends, he was the only one to graduate from college, he said. He explained, "Everyone else I grew up with is either dead or in prison." At each Safe Zone Friday event, BLAST leaders invite adults and kids to speak out about their needs and any long-standing issues in their neighborhood, including gun violence and conflicts with police. That allows Shule and other decision-makers who attend to hear directly from the community. A rainy day gave way to sunshine and a cool breeze by the time two dozen officers congregated on a recent Friday on a grassy corner of the Hoover Road complex shortly after 5 p.m. As children lined up for ice cream, Keenan and volunteers laid out food trays donated by Home Plate Restaurant, owned by supporter Brian Bibbins, whose son was coached by Keenan. Loudspeakers blasted a song that put perceptions about policing center stage. It started with the sound of blaring police sirens. Then a male voice, raw and staccato, rapped about George Floyd's death and the shooting of black people by police. The officers, a mix of city police and county sheriff's deputies, didn't flinch. They talked and bumped elbows with kids and their parents. One deputy threw a football across a muddy clearing to a boy. After passing out food and goodies to the kids, volunteers ushered residents and officers into a large circle around a grassy clearing. Devontae Smith, a BLAST co-founder, stepped forward and offered help. He said, "If you need to find a job, maybe we know somebody. If you need better relations with the police, you come talk to us." But mostly, he said, he wanted those present, including City Council members Dedriana Freeman and Pierce Freelon, to hear residents say what they needed. "Education," one woman offered. "Computers, basketballs, you know, simple stuff. A jump rope," added another. Residents called for better parks and community centers, too. Several parents said they wanted safe outdoor activities for their kids. Keenan said BLAST plans to respond to that need with Training in the Trenches, an after-school program BLAST will kick off this month. Police officers and former student athletes, including some of Keenan's former students, will teach kids sports ranging from football to golf. Officers did not speak during the circle at that Friday's event, but afterward, Durham Police Sergeant Darrell Macaluso said that community policing, where officers are assigned to neighborhoods where they get to know residents, is essential. He's with the department's Community Engagement Unit, which focuses on crime prevention in Durham's public housing communities. The department doesn't have enough officers to ensure that those who respond to a call know the people in neighborhoods where they are dispatched, he said. "I don't think that would have happened if the officers knew the kids," he said, referring to that Rochelle Manor incident. As the Safe Zone event finished, Hoover Road resident Dontre Cole, 45, was laughing and filming as BLAST volunteer Omar Hughes, 50, played a spirited game of basketball with one boy. "Almost, man. Get it," Cole chided as his neighbor's son ran across the packed dirt, dribbling past Humes to try to make a basket into an old hoop shorn of netting. Cole's expression became more pained as he described how he views the way people usually act with Hoover Road residents. He praised one white officer who he said comes and speaks with the kids every morning. But some officers were rude and hostile to residents they perceived as dressing or appearing similar to gang members, he said. "It gets to your heart," Cole said. "Don't treat us like zoo animals." Cole said that gunfire in and near the complex, which he attributes to gang members who don't live in Hoover Road, is a problem. "The kids are way too young. The shooting gets to their mind," he said. And Cole believes that events like Safe Zone could help with both gun violence and residents' relationship with the police. "That's what we need. Show their support," he said. "Come check on how everything's doing." And yet another column concerning Durham, this one by Sarah Pequeño, Bank Accountability. When Wells Fargo CEO Charles Scharf sent a memo to the entire company outlining the diversity initiatives they'd be taking in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, he included a note along with general promises to do better, writing, "The unfortunate reality is that there is a very limited pool of black talent to recruit from." Since Reuters broke that story on September 22nd, Scharf has been taken to task by everyone from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Karen Atia, who argued in the Washington Post that Scharf's statement showed the bank was, quote, "unwilling to move on from some of the worst racist parts of America's past." Scharf has since issued an apology, saying the comments reflected his own unconscious bias, but his statements are indicative of yet another industry where black people still face discrimination. That's why Zweli's Kitchen co-founder Leonardo Williams and social media manager Craig Carter created Bank Black Durham, a movement to encourage folks to bank with local black-owned banks. In doing so, their goal is to increase black home ownership by 10% in the next decade and grow the ranks of black-owned small businesses by 25% in the next 5 years. Williams says, "The law is not innocent, and neither are some of those infrastructures that we deal with, including and most definitely money." Around 30 people met at CCB Plaza on the warm October 3rd afternoon to hear Williams, Carter, and other guest speakers get the word out on the importance of black-owned and operated banks and creating tables for black North Carolinians instead of waiting to be invited to the metaphorical tables set up for and by white people. The group is pushing Durhamites to move their money to M&F Bank, whose Paris Street location has been operating since 1908. It's the second oldest minority-owned bank in the nation, according to the M&F website. Carter thought of the idea as he walked past the bank and considered how he learned at a young age that banking was the best way to keep your savings. For Williams, the movement is personal. He says he and his wife, Zweli, kept getting denied loans as they tried to turn their catering company into a brick-and-mortar restaurant. While Zweli's eventually opened without the help of a bank or loan company, Williams had to take on more risk. Meanwhile, he says white friends with the same circumstances, credit scores, and incomes were able to get loans on the first try. Williams now banks with M&F. Carter says he's in the process of moving his money over from Wells Fargo. Part of what they hoped to do with Bank Black is to walk people through that transition, which is more involved than withdrawing your life savings at an AT&M. Carter says, "People have so many services, Netflix, Venmo, all that stuff that's tied up with their bank. They have to work to shift all that over." Banking Black is about more than supporting a black-owned bank. It shapes the amounts they are able to lend within the community. And while corporate banks like Wells Fargo and Bank of America lend nationally, local banks keep money flowing through the community. Yvonne Lewis Hawley, Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, says she and her family have always banked with M&F. Hawley's personal and campaign accounts are both with the company. In a statement to Indy, she says it is important to support the institutions that support the community. As the rally wound down, Williams made it personal. He asked his 14-year-old son, Isaiah, to join him in front of the small crowd, saying this was about investing in the future, too. He said, "We're not going to go to a corporate bank that only looks at us as a number. We're going right up that street, right over there, where they were started for us." And now, Tomasi McDonald's article about the morality of mortality. This is a fairly long article, and there's a sidebar. I think I'll be able to get to it all. Doulas, like Maya Jackson, are birthing new ethics to solve the black maternal health crisis. High school senior Jasmir Taylor was excited about being pregnant. The petite 17-year-old Durham teen looked forward to having her baby, graduating, and then enrolling in college to study nursing. Jada Martin, her 18-year-old sister, said she found out she was pregnant in late December. She was very excited and started to get even more excited when it was time for him to come, 2 months before. She knew it was already going to be a boy, and she'd already picked out his name, Jules. She wanted to start with a J, because all our names start with a J. Martin says while her sister was pregnant, she slept a lot, ate, and laid around the house. She had prenatal care and regularly went to the doctor for checkups. Yasmir Taylor gave birth to her son on September 3rd at Duke Regional Hospital on Roxborough Road. Mom and baby went home on September 7th. The next day, she started complaining about pain and went back to Duke Regional. Martin says she was saying she couldn't breathe, basically. They couldn't get her blood pressure down. On September 10th, Yasmir Taylor died in the hospital where she had given birth just a week before. She was a month shy of turning 18. Taylor was the youngest of five children. The teen's devastated family isn't sure what killed her, and officials at Duke Regional haven't talked about her cause of death. Now her parents are taking care of baby Jules, who just turned 1 month old, as they await Yasmir's autopsy for answers. She didn't deserve this, Martin quietly says. In a statement to the Indy, Duke health officials said although the hospital could not comment on individual cases due to patient privacy concerns, quote, our hearts go out to families grieving the loss of a loved one. We are dedicated to providing excellent care to all the communities we serve. We acknowledge the racial disparities in maternal health that we experience in our state and nation, and have a long-held commitment to eradicating these disparities as one of the most important missions in our care of patients. Black maternal health advocates say Yasmir's death is just one example of how the black maternal health crisis plays out in Durham. Every year, about 700 women in the United States die from childbirth or pregnancy complications, according to the CDC, giving this country the highest maternal mortality rate of any developed nation in the world. Within those numbers, the health disparities faced by expectant black women and women of color are even more disturbing. Black women are about three times more likely to die due to pregnancy-related causes than white women, and often report being mistreated during their pregnancies. According to the NC Center for Health Statistics, last year in Durham County, black women were 1.6 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. Black maternal health advocates say the maternal mortality rate in Durham County is relatively low, owing to health, technological, and educational resources that are not available in rural areas. Yet, in 2018, the Durham County infant mortality rate among black newborns was more than three times higher than white babies. A battery of local organizations led by black women are trying to address the crisis by wrapping expectant mothers in a bundle of services to keep them and their babies alive and healthy. Equity Before Birth, a new nonprofit started in August, works to decrease black infant and maternal mortality rates by identifying black-owned and black-led businesses to sponsor prenatal care and postpartum support for expectant black moms. Of particular interest for the organization is supplementing the incomes of low-income mothers who don't have paid maternal leave, Executive Director Joy Spencer explains. The nonprofit is sponsoring three pregnant mothers this year by supplementing their incomes and providing them with birth doulas. Spencer says giving birth is very strenuous on the body. We have a lot of working-class women who have no choice but to work hourly-wage jobs without a paid maternity leave plan. They have to go back to work 2, 4, or 6 weeks before their bodies heal. But if they are given time for their bodies to heal, it improves their health outcomes over time, and spending more time with the baby promotes the baby's health. A second agency, Endayo, emphasizes wellness in its support of black women with birth doulas, life coaching, and workshops. The goal is to create safe spaces and emotional support that affirms, empowers, and uplifts black moms-to-be by focusing on their life experiences and wellness practices. the nonprofit Helping Each Adolescent Reach Their Spark, or HEARTS, educates and equips teen parents to become independent and self-sufficient. Birth doulas are at the center of mobilizing African-American mothers through empowerment, also known as MAAME, MAME, which trains doulas and advocates quality maternal care for Black, Indigenous, and women of color. Meanwhile, a group called the RENE offers a discussion-based community to address issues of pain in Black maternal care. The nonprofits are anchored by Sankofa Birth and Women's Care, the only practicing Black-owned midwife center in the state. Maya Jackson, a trained doula, says she founded MAME in 2018 to decrease maternal health disparities among Black women. She says, the United States has the worst maternal health outcomes amongst the developed nations in Europe and Asia. The United States is at the bottom. A lot of it has to do with our society not valuing birthing people as much as it values politics. We say we're pro-choice and love babies, but the system doesn't reflect that. A big issue in North Carolina is Medicaid has not been expanded. We have a lot of families who are falling through the cracks. Spencer, the Equity Before Birth director, says the goal is to fill those cracks in order to catch anyone who might slip through. What we want to do is bridge the gap between the community and medical institutions, Spencer says. We need the experiences of the people who have lived through these experiences to be valued. Spencer points to an unofficial network of women whose own pregnancy experiences have taught them how to wrap support around expectant Black moms that's not acknowledged by the medical system. Making sure new moms have access to food, doulas who help before and after birth, transportation, car seats, and even something as mundane and yet essential as shoulder rubs. There is a lens, she says, that those who are formally educated might not be able to see all the ways to heal. According to a study published in a 2019 issue of the Reproductive Health Journal, women of color who give birth in hospitals and expectant mothers who face social, economic, or health challenges reported higher rates of mistreatment. Expectant moms who reported the highest rates included women who had unexpected events like cesareans, and those who disagreed with healthcare providers about the right way to care for themselves or their babies. The 2,700 women who participated in that 2019 survey reported being shouted at or scolded by a healthcare provider, being ignored, or their request for help being refused. Some of the expectant moms also reported violations of physical privacy and health care providers threatening to withhold treatment or forcing them to accept treatment they did not want. It also found that expectant mothers, no matter their race, were more likely to be mistreated by health care providers if their partner was Black. The study surmised that how people are treated during childbirth can affect the health and well-being of the mother, child, and entire family. For Jackson, it's basic. She says, if the mom is thriving, the baby's thriving. If mom is stressed, the baby is stressed. Jasmere Taylor was laid to rest on September 16th following a funeral service at the River Church in South Durham. There were nearly 100 people in attendance, including at least 20 expectant mothers between the ages of 16 and 30 who were part of Taylor's circle of friends. Whit McWilliams, a doula who recently moved to Durham, attended the memorial service. She has some ideas about what likely happened to the radiant teen. She says she was young, Black, and on Medicaid. That weighs on her story. The health care providers just wouldn't listen to her. The words of some of Taylor's friends that day stuck with her. She says, the community response at her funeral was heartbreaking but powerful. Those who were pregnant were saying, I need some type of support because what happened to her has scared me. And others were saying, man, this is another thing we have to worry about. We know about police brutality and the street violence that's always there, but now the medical system isn't safe for us either. Readers who would like to donate to Jasmir Taylor's funeral expenses and a trust fund on behalf of, well, Jules Taylor, can visit https://gf.me/u/yx2rc7. That looks like a GoFundMe site. Now we have time for our op-ed column called Place Value, which was written by Laura McCann. There is an increasing need for affordable housing throughout Wake County. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, estimates that 12 million renters and homeowners spend more than 50% of their household income on housing costs. Considering that it has long been recommended to spend 30% or less on housing, this leaves millions of American households struggling to afford everyday necessities, including food, clothing, and medical care. This especially holds true during the COVID-19 pandemic, which has caused drastic changes to personal finances. Raleigh Housing Authority, RHA, is the largest provider of affordable housing in Raleigh. RHA offers public housing and Section 8 vouchers to approximately 5,700 families in the area. The agency utilizes subsidy from the federal government, allowing it to provide rental rates based on the household income. Many households may qualify for assistance, but be unaware of RHA programs and their eligibility criteria. Additionally, stigmas and misconceptions surrounding subsidized housing often deter individuals from participating in housing programs as residents or as landlords. Terms like public housing and Section 8 housing evoke images of institutional barrack-style communities. However, RHIA's design and management of new developments blends its properties into surrounding communities so that they are not distinguishable as subsidized housing. In the voucher program, homes are rented from private landlords, and RHA assists with rental subsidy. Voucher households are fully integrated into a variety of areas completely independent from RHA-managed properties. Another common misconception is that people living in subsidized housing don't work. This is simply not true. The majority of adult residents capable of working do so, many working multiple jobs to increase their household income. Our residents work as teachers, paramedics, bus drivers, courthouse officials, and in other occupations invaluable to the fabric of our society. RHA provides housing to a variety of different income levels, which provides a way for families to have housing stability and a means to help break the cycle of poverty. RHA even offers an incentive public housing program that specifically aims to help individuals and families who work full-time or are elderly and or disabled. Those eligible for incentive housing based on employment have been working full-time for 2 years prior to admission and must continue working full-time for the duration of their assistance. Incentive housing encourages working families to transition into market-rate housing, up to and including home ownership. One RHA resident says participation in an incentive housing program allows her to increase her financial self-sufficiency by working and going to school for a bachelor's degree. This resident has been able to increase her credit score and save money and is in the process of purchasing a home for herself and her two children. She says, "The number one thing low to moderate income people stress over is how will they pay rent and will they have enough? I'm grateful for the program and what it's allowed for me to do for myself. It wasn't always easy, but I found a way to make it work." Another misconception with subsidized housing is that residents do not go through a screening process prior to receiving assistance. RHA has a rigorous screening process that considers criminal background, rental history, sex offender status, and more. Applying for housing does not guarantee that assistance will be awarded. While RHA is laser-focused on its mission, safe, decent, affordable housing, the agency helps connect residents with opportunities that will better equip them to improve their lives. Program policies and regulations may require residents to meet service requirements, including home ownership classes, financial literacy classes, or community service hours. Furthermore, RHA partners with agencies and resident organizations to bring additional opportunities to its residents, including food banks, YMCAs, mental health organizations, churches, and more. RHA encourages Wake County residents to explore ways that they can help bolster affordable housing within their community. Individuals with rental homes can sign up as private landlords with Section 8 housing. Neighbors, friends, and family can assist others by offering access to things like phone, the internet, or help with appointments. Additionally, you can see if they need help understanding the process, following their lease agreement, communicating with their landlord, or paying their rent on time. To learn more about Raleigh Housing Authority programs, visit rhaonline.com or call the main office, 919-831-8300, 919-831-8300. Now, with about 6 minutes left, I have time for at least one arts-related article from Indie Week, Crown Jewels, a music review by Charles Morse. Good rap music can be like soul food, made with hearty ingredients, not especially complicated but in its preparation, but not easy to imitate. Without love and passion, it'll never taste like your auntie's Sunday spread. There's just something magical that happens when bona fide pros with decades of tradition and love sweat it out in the kitchen. If you're looking for a rap album that will warm your soul and feed your hunger for wholesome bars and beats, Crown Royal by OC from NC and Drugs, D-R-U-G-S, Beats, is your Sunday spread. Based in Burlington, OC is a veteran in independent rap circles, known for his effortless delivery of razor-sharp bars. He's a man who doesn't compromise his standards as an MC and makes the kind of music that he loves no matter what's trending. On Crown Royal, he teamed up with Fayetteville's DRUGS, Drugs Beats, one of the greatest sample-based producers to ever tap an MPC, who's previously contributed to Dr. Dre's Grammy-nominated album, Compton. This union is something that North Carolina hip-hop heads have been dreaming about for years, and the duo does not disappoint. The two artists have an amazing synergy. Drugs production, though exclusively boom-bap, doesn't sound precedented. He has a talent for finding pockets within samples that glide together with his drum programming, even easing back on the drum sometimes to let a riff loop out for OC to spit on. You hear this in Anton Jackson, where Drugs lays out some subtle drums for OC's first verse, then takes him out completely to let a vocal sample of a quartet loop as OC flows like molasses with a drawly, pitched-down effect. It's like Memphis bumped into Brooklyn somewhere on I-40 in North Carolina. Another high point is Jameson, which features a haunting, gritty sample of what sounds like a horror movie score, accompanied by heavily reverbed drums and a hyped vocal sample from Super Beagle. OC gets disrespectful on this one with growling raps like, "'Cause where I'm from, you gotta up it. I ain't even tough. Just two niggers ain't really bluffin'." Crown Royal is a testament to the fact that impeccable raps and beats will always be relevant in hip-hop. This project put two veterans who love their craft in the same room, and the result is an album that sits as one of the best hip-hop releases of 2020. And that's not just by local standards. And Byron Woods, writing about stage, reviews Waiting for the Heart from the Raleigh Little Theater, and I may have to curtail this, but I'll get started on it. Casting Doubt. The struggle to shrink the proscenium stage to your laptop screen goes on in waiting for the host. The prolific horrors and absurdities of 2020 have repeatedly beggared description. The only reason we'd hesitate to apply CNN's host Jake Tapper's description of last week's presidential debate, quote, a hot mess inside a dumpster fire inside a train wreck, to the whole wretched year would be the credible fear that something even worse still lurks between now and December 31. Theodora, an Episcopal priest who's a central character in Raleigh Little Theater's virtual production of Waiting for the Host, has plenty of company amongst those feeling godforsaken in the real world. There's no shortage of theater artists in that number. Amputated from their audiences in the spring and evicted from live venues, they've been forced to reinvent themselves almost overnight as practitioners of another genre altogether, a weird online hybrid of film and television, with technical requirements that impose an aesthetic fundamentally different from conventional theater. With few exceptions, the entire theatrical cohort has necessarily been learning to crawl ever since. Amid flashes of brilliance and no small amount of beginner's luck in exceptional showings like the Women's Theater Festival's Natural Shocks in March, theater groups have mainly struggled while trying to acquire new technical and artistic fluency. That struggle continues in Waiting for the Host. Artistic director Patrick Torres tries to recalibrate his cast performances from the overbroad gestures appropriate in the full proscenium theater to the subtler micro-gestures needed when acting for laptop cameras set up only a few feet away. But with few exceptions, actors overshot and overacted on opening night. Well, Mr. Woods gives this production 2.5 stars and says it was, opening night was, the script was a little undeveloped characters and the actors overshot and overacted on opening night. And apologizing, but this article and the entire program has to end before I can finish. Indie Week, as you know, is always available in the podcast section of our website, which is ncreadingservice.org. And so, John Feddersen, your reader today for ncreadingservice.org, is closing our broadcast out for this week and hope that you'll join us again next week for the next issue of Indie Week. So long.